This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the Supreme Court gives conservatives a huge win in the Hobby Lobby case. Also, Congress totally gives up on immigration reform. What should Obama do about it? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, is HBO's new show The Leftovers deliciously dark or just really, really dark? Then, The Onion spin-off website Clickhole is the next wave of journalistic satire. You won't believe what we have to say about it. And then, the film They Came Together is a parody of a movie genre already replete with self-parody, the rom-com.
I know, it sounds transparent, but she sounded really sincere.
Oh, well, great story.
Yeah, we should get together again very soon.
We're not done.
Yeah, sit down.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. Conservatives on the Supreme Court took another nibble out of the Affordable Care Act this week. The court ruled that Hobby Lobby can't be forced to cover certain kinds of contraception for its employees because it violates the company's religious beliefs. What's going to happen next? Then, John Boehner declares immigration reform dead in the House. President Obama responds with executive action on child immigrants and border security. Why has immigration reform become a symbol of all that is wrong with Washington? I'm joined in Washington by Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hey, David.
And in Amsterdam, no less, is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
The Supreme Court finished its term with a bang this week, giving a 5-4 victory to Hobby Lobby in its suit over Obamacare's contraceptive mandate. This court cast its ruling in narrow terms, as it always does when it wants to stick a wedge in for a bigger win later. The conservative majority found that closely held for-profit corporations, whatever those may be, could be exempted from the mandate that they provide certain kinds of contraceptive coverage to employees, including IUDs and Plan B. Under a 1993 law, RFRA, which is an acronym.
Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yes. The contraceptive mandate was not the, quote, least restrictive means of meeting the government interest in providing contraception, so Hobby Lobby gets to escape it. Emily, let's start with the basic Bazelon legal reasoning question. What was the legal reasoning of the majority? What were you persuaded by?
Well, so the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, like you said, it was a bipartisan Congress that passed it in 1993, and they were upset about a previous Supreme Court decision that liberals and conservatives felt went too far in forcing people, persons was the word the law used, to follow laws that apply to everyone, even if those laws burden the exercise of religion. So Hobby Lobby comes in. First move they make is to say that persons in the law includes for-profit corporations. And then they say that they have religious beliefs as a company that are violated by paying for four forms of contraception that they see as causing abortion, the IUD and a couple versions of the morning after pill, and they threw one more thing in kind of late in the litigation. So the first question is Hobby Lobby, in fact, entitled to any protection at all under this law? And in previous cases, the Supreme Court had never ruled that a for-profit corporation was what Congress intended to protect when they passed this Religious Freedom Act. Now, lo and behold, the conservatives think that indeed Congress did intend to include corporations. I don't think that's the easiest reading of the law. However, lots of people feel like this is a relatively close question. So then the next thing, once you're in the land of RFRA and you're protected, the next question is, did the government have a compelling interest in putting coverage for contraception into Obamacare as part of the preventive health care package for women? Lots of evidence from the Institute of Medicine, which the Obama administration had asked to study the issue, that in fact contraception clearly benefits women's health. And this is the uncontroversial part that you alluded to earlier, right? That everybody uses contraception, everyone thinks it's part of how the world works. But when you limit the definition of the challenge forms of birth control to these supposed abortifacients, you kind of muddy the waters a little. And the Obama administration never stood up for the science behind treating the IUD and the morning after pill as birth control rather than abortifacients. They just said, well, Hobby Lobby sincerely believes they cause abortion, and so we're not going to kind of lift that veil. I think that proved to be a big mistake in the litigation, because then the conservatives on the court can just accept that and move on. And in fact, Justice Alito's most, to me, disturbing move was to say, well, we'll assume for the purpose of argument the government had an interest in providing for contraception through health insurance, but we're not going to say they really proved their case. And in fact, Alito then kind of cast aspersions on that whole notion. And that was the part of the opinion that made me just want to start screaming and ranting, because it felt like such a misunderstanding of how women's health works and such a blow to women to be criticizing and deriding that part of it. But that brings us to the last question here, which is, did the Obama administration use what the law calls the least restrictive means of accomplishing this goal? And the idea is that if the government's going to go around burdening people's religious freedom, well, they should use this, quote, least restrictive means. I hate these legal tests. I think they get really silly. But when you're in that land, it's relatively easy to say, no, there was another way. So Alito's kind of clever move here was to say, well, the Obama administration had already accepted churches and some nonprofit religious organizations. Why don't we just extend that accommodation to these poor for-profit businesses that don't want to pay for this, which means you have conservatives crying for the government to have taxpayers spend more money on something that they had paid for in a different way. But never mind. That's the world that we're now in. The good news about the move that Alito made at the end was it appears that Congress can fix this problem, although there is also all this outstanding litigation from various nonprofits about whether this accommodation actually works the way they want it to. And Alito made it clear that he wasn't saying one way or the other to keep those cases alive. That's kind of the legal rationale behind all this. And then, of course, the question is, like, what happens next, both legally and, I think, politically? Where does this go from here?
So, John, you're a reasonable man who always wants to look for compromise in the world. The original issue here, there's the Obama administration made an original accommodation for religious entities to allow them to get around this contraceptive coverage. First of all, was that accommodation a mistake? Should they not have made it? Second of all, once they've made that accommodation, do you think that Hobby Lobby is a natural and indeed reasonable kind of outcome, that this is a way of dealing with some people's very strong beliefs, that America has a historic tradition of allowing people to practice their religion as broadly as possible, and that this is a way to reach that?
Right. So there is an accommodation that we've given throughout our history. RFRA was itself an attempt to rebalance that accommodation. And going back to the original Affordable Care Act, I think you have two possibilities. One, that the president and those who wrote it believe there should be this accommodation, who believe that you should carve out a place in the law for very small and specific cases where people who have closely held religious views, where in whatever way their views weren't being trampled on. I think that's as a matter of belief. I think secondarily, it also was a huge red flag. In terms of, it could have been a huge political fight. So you try and carve out the accommodation to get the bill passed, saying, look, we're not doing anything with this bill that tramples on this on these existing sets of beliefs. And there were all kinds of ways in which the bill tried to sort of wend its way through the minefields. And this is just one of the ones it was trying to wend its way through. Had they not made that accommodation, we still would have been in the courts. I mean, Hobby Lobby wasn't going to, like, say, I mean, they were still going to do this, and the court was likely going to make its decision the way it did. I'm not sure that – I mean, they would have had a different rationale in Alito's. Alito wouldn't have been able to refer to the accommodation in the original legislation, but he would have referred to something else. I think one of the most interesting things here that somebody should take a long look at is the way in which the Affordable Care Act basically changed women's reproductive rights on both the positive and the negative scale. So on the one hand, you have all kinds of women who now have access to contraception. On the other hand, you have all of these legislatures that were brought in. There were nine fully Republican legislatures before the 2010 election. There were 21 after it. A lot of those legislatures were brought into power because of the big backlash against the Affordable Care Act. Those 21 legislatures then imposed lots of restrictions on women's reproductive rights, both specifically with respect to the Affordable Care Act, but then all kinds of other things.
Abortion.
And all kinds of mainly abortion.
And so, funding for family planning, too.
Precisely. And so had all those legislators not been voted into office as a backlash to the Affordable Care Act, how would the legislation have been different? How would the effect on abortion and the whole range of women's reproductive decisions have been different? And I think it would be interesting to go through that whole math equation, because there's been a huge change in the way that pro-choice efforts have been, pro-life efforts have worked at the state level because of the wave of victories right. in 2010 that were all a part of the backlash to the Affordable Care Act.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, I would say the quick and dirty math is 30 million women already have access to contraception being paid for who didn't. They're expecting up to 43 million, I think. And yet you have abortion clinics closing throughout the South as well as other parts of the country. And the real question of whether people just aren't going to lose any kind of viable access. So that's the balance.
All right. I want to take us to one last point from you, Emily, and then wrap this. The last point I'm interested in from you is Justice Ginsburg indicated that she thinks this is a wedge kind of case. Certainly a lot of the legal scholars on the left think this is a wedge kind of case, that in fact, Dahlia Lithwick, our dear colleague who writes about the Supreme Court, made the case that this whole term could be seen as a kind of wedge term where the justices are planting seeds, conservative justices are planting seeds for things that will come into bloom later. What is the broad end of the wedge? What's going to happen next time?
Well, two thoughts. One is that one of the most interesting aspects of the wedge or the incrementalism of this term was how Justice Alito wrote the big two decisions. He wrote Hobby Lobby and he wrote Harris versus Quinn, the union decision, both of which are take steps towards some much bigger move. Usually when we see the court engaged in that very interesting, perhaps sinister, and important activity, it is Chief Justice Roberts who is writing the opinion. So he has now gotten Alito on board for his approach, which is not the Scalia approach, right? Scalia yells and screams. You have no question about what his end goal is. He tries to accomplish as much of it as possible in each case he gets to write. But now we see Alito clearly joining Roberts over here in incrementalism land, which is really interesting. And if you worry about that the real end goals of incrementalism will actually accomplish more for the right, then this is, you know, kind of a big thing to have Alito now signed up for this mission. And then Hobby Lobby sets up a couple of things. It sets up potentially one of these businesses that, like the New Mexico photographers, that doesn't want to provide service to gay people. Because if you have businesses protected by religious freedom, as Congress has defined it, then you're setting up the idea that businesses have the right to refuse to serve for religious reasons, which is, we've never gone there in American law, right? You know, even during the civil rights era, no one ever said, oh, these businesses have a constitutional or a statutory right not to serve.
Coming up, the nasty, disastrous politics of immigration reform. You're listening to Gabfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gabfest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political Gabfest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Immigration, what a mess. A year ago, a bipartisan Senate majority passed an immigration reform bill that would have offered a long but genuine path to citizenship for the many millions of undocumented immigrants who live here. It would have beefed up border security, increased visas for highly skilled workers that we want to come. It would have done lots of things that most reasonable people believe need to be done for immigration and that almost every single person believes would help the economy significantly. The Republican House has sat on the bill for a year. This week, John Boehner apparently told the president in a private conversation that there would not be a vote on this bill as part of John Boehner's campaign, as part of the Republicans' campaign to grind Washington to a complete halt. The president has responded with a promise of executive action on this action that would make it easier to send back a lot of the child migrants. We have a child migrant crisis that's developing. John, immigration, it seems to me, has become a symbol for all that's wrong. Here's a policy. Everyone knows the policy needs to be changed. It's in the entire country's interest for the policy to change. There's general consensus in the population about how the policy should change, yet the policy will not change.
Right. There are all kinds of other things where the will of the people is at odds with the behavior of the lawmakers.
Gun control.
Gun control would be one. And then also from the Republican perspective, the numbers on gun control are quite high in terms of the number of people who want it. I think the point of immigration is that you do have more progress on it and you have more forces engaged in it than on almost anything else. So when we talk about the failure of a big grand budget deal, there's not a whole lot of support in Republican ranks for, say, tax increases, and there's none for marginal tax increases. But here you had 13 senators vote for it last, Republican senators vote for it last summer. It was what you would what we sort of expect when we think about legislation. You got Democrats and Republicans to vote for something, and then it moved through to the next body. And it died there basically because Republicans don't want to have a big fight about immigration with themselves in a year when they think they're going to retake the Senate. That's the main reason, at least as reported to me by Republican senators and congressmen. John Boehner said it was because they don't trust the president that they didn't do it. And that's true. They don't trust the president, and but they also don't trust those who are in the not entrusting camp. They don't trust Republicans either. They didn't trust the Senate. That's why the House never brought up the Senate bill and never intended to, because those who are violently opposed to this, but who might someday support comprehensive immigration reform, want are guarantees that the border will be shut and locked and people will be kept out.
I think you give them so much more credit than they deserve with this idea, oh, we just want border security. It's an idea of complete and total opposition to a presidential agenda and using that nihilism and objectionism to prevent anything from happening in government while he's president.
Look, when you think about the things that motivate a House member, are they thinking more about Eric Cantor losing or not liking the president? They're thinking more about Eric Cantor losing. When you talk to House members and you talk to people in House leadership, when they talk about what worries these members, what they say is, yes, the Chamber of Commerce is beating us up about this. Yes, the evangelicals are beating us up about this. But those two groups can't create a primary opponent that can vote these guys out. They don't mention Barack Obama is not in the conversation.
So one of the things that's happening, John, is that the president is going to take some executive action unilaterally. It's not exactly clear what he's going to do, but there's some indications. And John Boehner is making noises that the House is sick and tired of the president taking unilateral action, and they're thinking of litigation against the president. And the president was like, "So sue me." What is there actually going to be litigation?
So in July we'll find out. Boehner said he will drop a bill in July that will have the particulars of where they think the president has overreached and gone beyond his executive authority. A lot of
a
it will
bill
be,
or as opposed to a lawsuit. How do you pass it? Oh, you
they
pass
have
a bill
to pass the
overreach?
Bill to do the lawsuit. They have to pass the bill to get the lawsuit.
But they won't be able to pass it through the Senate.
No, but I think they
could have standing anyway.
I think they might have standing anyway, but I also think they might not, because obviously it would never get through the Senate. This is largely a stunt, though the belief is closely held, which is they think the president on, you know, basically exempting portions of the Affordable Care Act has overstepped his bounds, that you can't just change legislation willy-nilly that's been passed. So we'll see what they actually try to argue, because we don't have a lawsuit in front of us. What Boehner is trying to do, though, is with the Affordable Care Act no longer juicing people the way juicing Republicans who are going to vote in an off-year election, a non-presidential year election, not juicing it the way that it had before. They want to take on the president again and milk the anger people have with the president. And so they're making this case about overreach, and they'll add to that what the president did in response to the death of immigration reform, which has been dead all year, as we talked about and wrote about, because of the forces we were just talking about within the Republican Party. The president said, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to work by executive order. But there's not that much he can do. He can redirect money that goes to immigration efforts in the interior part of the country and help with these courts and the flying of these kids on the border to other courts in California that are able to adjudicate them and send them back home. And he can do a few tiny little things by executive order.
Wait
but
a minute.
Not
he
much.
Has deported 2 million people. He could stop deporting a lot of people.
He doesn't want to stop doing that.
Well, that's because he's trying to appear tough on immigration so he can impress the Republicans about, you know, how much he means border control to get a bill passed. I mean, or maybe he really does believe we should throw all these people out of the country. But it's not true that he doesn't have that much power. He could really deportation. It would have a huge effect.
He doesn't have that much power to do any of the stuff that he believes should be legislatively done.
So, Emily, I want to actually close this topic by talking about one of the particulars of this, which is that we have this just heartbreaking and strange child immigration crisis where there have been tens and tens of thousands of Latin American kids who are making their way into the country illegally. Many are Mexican, but now increasingly they're Central American. There are 50,000, I believe, kids being held in makeshift detention in this country because we don't exactly know what to do with them. If you're Mexican and you get caught, I think it's fairly there are procedures in place where you can kick a kid who's Mexican.
If you don't get very far, that's true. We have this weird sort of quasi-second border for the Mexicans.
But if you're Central American, you get a lot more due process. You can't just be thrown out of the country. I found myself actually literally crying and turning off an NPR story the other day because it was just too excruciating about a five-year-old who's made his way, you know, with a coyote up here and is alone and what the hell. But what should we do? I'm asking you guys this as parents, as human beings. What should we do with these children who get here?
Yeah. God. I mean, I think they all should have hearings, and basically, particularly if they were trying to unite with family here, we should just send them to their family. I do think that there's this very moving but also ironic way in which all these Central American families are kind of calling the United States on some kind of bet, where the word, as I understand it, that's going back to Central America is that if you get here, you get a permiso to stay if you're a child. And all that means is that you get a hearing. But I guess just that separate hearing, or there have been enough cases of people who have stayed, have created this confusion that there's somehow some more automatic right of legal residency for children, which is not true. I have to say that I don't fundamentally really understand the sending away of small children on such a treacherous and dangerous journey, except if you had someone to meet them here, at least that would make it a little bit different. But it's really very fundamentally confusing to me why exactly this is happening.
Why they're coming?
Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine thinking it would be so much better here for a small child to come without their parents. I mean, if you're coming to meet an aunt or a grandmother, then I guess that's the bargain people make and they think they'll get to stay. And I mean, frankly, I think those kids should be allowed to stay. But that, you know, the problem is that it's always easy to say things like that. And in the end, do you really believe in open borders? I mean, open borders seem to me like they are never going to work. And so I'm not actually sure what the end game of what I'm saying is. I'm having a kind of knee-jerk, compassionate response that maybe is not very realistic. I don't know. So hard.
So hard. Okay. That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, They Came Together sends up romantic comedies like Spinal Tap did to rock and roll. Could it kill off a genre forever? And then The Leftovers is brain teaser TV in the True Detective mode. It's pretty gripping, but is it a little too metaphysical, perhaps? And finally, Clickhole is The Onion's new parody website. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
Dana Stevens is out this week, and replacing her is, whether adequately or inadequately, we'll discover soon enough, John Swansburg, who is editorial director of Slate. John, are you up to it? Do you think you can be as, like, kind of universally beloved and clever with a tincture of acid as Dana Stevens is?
No, definitely not. I could never aspire to be as wonderful as Dana, but I will do my darndest to be entertaining nonetheless.
That was a really warm welcome, Steve.
Yeah, seriously. Thanks, buddy.
Anytime. All right. Well, anyway, They Came Together is an absurdist parody in the airplane mode of romantic comedies. It was directed by David Wayne and written by Wayne and Michael Showalter, both veterans of The State and Adult Swim. It stars Amy Poehler and Paul Rudd, and it sends up every cliche in the rom-com playbook. Why don't we listen to a clip from the movie?
Joel, Molly, how'd you two meet?
Oh, boy. Well, that's a long story.
Yeah. Oh, we got time. Waiter. More wine?
Well, it's kind of a corny, romantic comedy kind of story.
That's true. Yeah. That is true.
Really? How so?
Well, Joel's kind of a typical romantic comedy leading man, you know? He's handsome, but in a non-threatening way.
Yeah, I can see that.
Vaguely, but not overtly Jewish.
You're right. Just Jewish enough.
And Molly is the kind of cute, klutzy girl that sometimes will drive you a little bit crazy, but you can't help but fall in love with her.
Guilty.
Okay, so we have our main characters.
Not quite. there was another character that was just as important as the two of us. New York City.
So New York City is like another character.
Yeah. Oh, so much promise. So much promise in this premise. Did you guys feel like it achieved liftoff?
I lifted off. Let me put it this way. I laughed consistently all the way through, but it's a very hard premise to sustain, isn't it, John Swansburg?
I think it is a very hard premise to sustain because, for one thing, you kind of have to keep hitting the same beats that the romantic comedy hits. And I felt like the movie sometimes mocked them in withering, hilarious fashion, like that setup we just listened to was really well done. But other times during the movie, I was sort of sitting there waiting for the next turn that I knew was coming because I've seen romantic comedies before and sort of fidgeting and kind of looking at my watch even though the movie was only 83 minutes long. And I felt like sometimes it skewered those conventions well and other times it was done less well. And I felt like the batting average by the end of the movie was, you know, like a respectable 258.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I laughed a lot, actually. You know, it's certainly a pleasant way to pass the time. But it didn't quite tip over. I mean, the one credit you did not mention in your setup of this film, Steve, is Wet Hot American Summer, which is the cult classic and utterly beloved send-up of the summer camp movie made by these same creators and many of the same actors more than 10 years ago now. And I was trying to figure out why this movie, despite being a scant 83 minutes long, still feels a little bit slack and uneven. Like the funny bits were very funny, but altogether I wasn't like, I don't want to take anyone by the lapels and be like, you've got to see this film. You've just got to. And I was trying to figure out why that might be. And I wonder if it's that the summer camp movie is a less predictable beast and thus it is possible to send it up in a fashion that can take on its own plot and its own form and have its own satisfactions, where as the template of the romantic comedy is just so known at this point that this movie was sort of predictable and the characters didn't seem to have real selves or lives beyond their parody of the structure of it. Maybe I'm misremembering Wet Hot American Summer, but I feel like those characters were deeply weird but somehow real as opposed to just cardboard figures being moved around.
I think that's exactly right. I actually went back and watched Wet Hot American Summer Sunday night and like completely enjoyed it as much as I did the first and second and third time I'd seen it, you know, whatever that was 10 years ago. And I think your analysis is spot on. And also I think that those guys, Wayne and Showalter, really love the summer camp movie. And so while it was a send-up of that genre, it was also kind of like a slightly more loving send-up. Like they were kind of turning up the volume on the absurdity of some of those movies, but they were also just kind of, you could tell that they had probably grown up watching those films and loving them and obsessing over them. Whereas here, this isn't like a sort of mean-spirited movie, but I think it's meant to be a more pointed satire of the romantic comedy. And I feel like as a result, it's a little bit less fun.
Yeah. I didn't see Wet Hot American Summer. I'm embarrassed to say now I'm going to run out and see it. But this movie kept reminding me of Spinal Tap. I think Spinal Tap is 83, and it was still early enough in the transition from album rock and roll to hip-hop that it was shocking to send up the pieties of rock and roll. And what you discovered as you watched the movie is, in fact, how rote and how routine the story of a band had become. And you realize it's no longer possible to like meet your school chum on the subway platform and form the Rolling Stones, that had gotten really long in the tooth. And so it brought to consciousness something you were already half aware of, which is that this thing really has gotten routine. You know, this thing that's supposed to be the opposite of routine has gotten completely standardized. So it raises, I think, all these interesting questions about romantic comedies. And I'm curious to hear what you guys think about this. Can you not make a rom-com anymore in the same way that you can't form the Rolling Stones on a subway platform? And if you can't, or if you can't really make one the way we used to make them, does that say something about the state of movies, about audience expectations, or the decay of romance? I mean, what is that about?
The decay of romance.
Wow.
That's a lot to pin on modern culture.
Well, one thought I had coming off of your Spinal Tap observation was that I think one reason that this movie fell a little flat for me, at least in parts, is that I didn't have that feeling in watching They Came Together that, oh my God, they are pointing out that the tropes and the format of the traditional romantic comedy have gotten so long in the tooth. I didn't even realize like how ridiculous these conventions were until this movie held them up to the light to me. On the contrary, I sort of felt like this movie was making fun of romantic comedy traits that already feel very hoary in our culture. And honestly, like a lot of the jokes about romantic comedies in this movie were jokes about You've Got Mail. I mean, this was like sending up a romantic comedy sort of circa 1996 to my mind in a lot of ways. And it sort of didn't grapple with the evolution of the romantic comedy in the more recent times. I mean, I think if you watch a movie like Bridesmaids, like there's so much more going on in that sort of contemporary version of the romantic comedy that this movie is sort of left aside in order to kind of skewer the, you know, muffin ordering punctiliousness of Meg Ryan in When Harry Met Sally. And like what they, you know, they had fun in that scene, but the movie felt a little belated to me.
Yeah, I think you're right on the money, John, that they're skewering an older version of what the romantic comedy used to do. And I think, you know, in terms of whether there can be romantic comedies anymore, Steve, I think there are fewer of them, and the ones that there are have to be a little bit cleverer and kind of transcend some of these tropes already. So it's almost like the Hollywood machine has gotten smarter than the satirists here, and that's never a position you want to be in a satirist. You never want to have the actual product you're satirizing make you look a little bit dumb and slow-footed.
That means the satirists are behind the eight ball, point well taken. But I mean, you know, the fact that something has become factory product and utterly predictable has never, ever slowed the assembly line in Hollywood one tiny bit, right? So there's something about, we're all completely aware of how predictable action movies and you know, movies based on comic books are, and here comes Transformers number, you know, N plus one, right? I mean, and yet there is something about, like, we have zero tolerance for, I mean, do you think the Forum is still alive, John, that Bridesmaids is really a rom-com? It doesn't seem to me to be a romantic comedy in its essence.
Yeah, well, I think it has elements of the romantic comedy, but it's also about female friendship, and I think that that's probably where most of the runtime of that movie is concentrated and the reason that people love it so much. So in a way, yeah, maybe it doesn't fit the genre. It's not a genre I much like or ever have liked, even at its pinnacle, so I don't know if I'm the person to sign its death certificate or not. I've never thrilled to the romantic comedy, or at least
because the romance has decayed within you.
Yeah, well, exactly, man. The last romantic comedy that I liked was The Apartment. So, you know, there you go. I think you and I agree on that, Steve. No?
Oh, you people are insufferable. Come on. The romantic comedies can be great, and you have to swoon a little bit for it, and you have to believe in the characters. And that's why, like, I think the ideal romantic comedy would send up the romantic comedy but also transport you to a land of feeling like maybe these characters are meant for each other in some goofy, beyond absurdist way. Like,
okay, but let's push on this just a little bit, though. It has to be generational, right? There was something about the, you know, confluence of different audience demographics that in the 80s and 90s, this was a major pop art form, the romantic comedy. Since we can zero out repetitiveness and predictability as reasons not for Hollywood not to make a movie, what is the reason? It must be, I think it's got to be a demographic fact that the tolerance for a certain kind of screen romance is actually quite low right now.
Well, no? I think probably the biggest change in the way Hollywood thinks about funding movies has to do with the global market for movies. And the thing that you often read in analyses of this, and I don't know enough to know whether it's true or not, but it sounds plausible, is that as these films are getting, you know, the films that get the budget, that get the backing, that get the marketing are films that can be anticipated to open huge all around the globe and have global stakes. Mm-hmm. So in every single movie, the world is on the line and something's getting blown up and, a pair of sinewy scientists, one male, one female, are forever having to band together across the globe to save humankind. I mean, there's romance of a sort in there, but it's just buried under a lot of flamethrowers.
But to the ever-sufferable Julia Turner, I say, I got you someplace interesting, which is that you're telling me that the satire gets it exactly wrong, that in fact romantic comedies are not generic enough for the global marketplace, which is why the Forum has died, which is why this is untimely. This movie is untimely.
Well, I think
QED.
Can I say my favorite scene? I know we've talked about this movie for a long time, but I really liked he's right in the beginning. The Paul Rudd character is going to propose to like the bad girlfriend who, you know, she's bad because her name is Tiffany. And he goes and plays a game of pickup basketball with all of his friends. And each friend sort of represents a viewpoint. And they start by saying, you know, like, you just got to get out there and get laid every night. That's what being a man is about. And then the married one is like, marriage is the most amazing thing that ever happened to me. And then there's like a poet friend. And then they just start getting meta. Like, I'm the one who represents the viewpoint of X. I felt like that. Mm-hmm. That felt fresh.
Yeah, no, that was great. And they couldn't hit a shot on the basketball court, which was a nice touch.
And keep saying swish every time they brick it. It's a cute. cute. It's a really cute movie. It's available on iTunes. It's called They Came Together. It stars the wonderful Paul Rudd and the equally wonderful Amy Poehler. Check it out. Come to our Facebook page. Tell us whether you think modern romance has decayed. We're at facebook.com/culturefest.
I officially snorted in response to you. Gotten my first Audible GabFest snort.
Coming up is HBO's The Leftovers, too gut-wrenchingly sad to binge-watch. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Julia Turner and John Swansburg, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for the things that we mentioned on the program, well, guess what? We collect them for you on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. Please, while you're there, if you would, just leave a comment. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right, on to our next topic. The Leftovers is the new HBO TV show based on a novel of the same name by Tom Perata. He co-created the series with a veteran of the TV show Lost. The Leftovers tells the story of one small town as it tries to make sense of the events of October 14th, the day when 2% of the world's population in an instant disappeared without a trace or an explanation. What to make of what appears to be a global rapture? All right, John. Well, obviously the show is structured around an obvious kind of glaring question, which is where did these people go? Why did they go there? On and on and on. But it's made up of, in the actual, you know, telling of it, sort of mini big questions that are implied by the disappearance. Who are we? Are we the saved or the damned? So there's that. It's like big metaphysical TV, as I said, in the True Detective mode. It's also genre TV. You're either going to be gripped by it or not gripped by it. I'm really curious what your reaction was.
I'm not sure if I would say I was gripped by it. It definitely is very successful in positing a bunch of questions, both the big ones you already mentioned and smaller ones about sort of the mechanics of what's going on in this world post-rapture. There, at least in the first episode, it seems like they're setting many different balls in motion down a hill, and almost maybe too many, because you don't really spend much time with each of the different characters you're introduced to. It seems like there's this cult called the Guilty Remnant that dresses all in white and doesn't speak and chain smokes, and the sort of secrets of their organization are sort of introduced but barely investigated. And then there's another cult with a sort of charismatic leader who seems to accept large envelopes of money in exchange for hugs, which apparently relieve people of the rapture-induced anxiety that they are harboring in their bodies. So I was definitely – my curiosity was piqued. But for me, the tone of the first episode at least was so relentlessly bleak that I felt a little beaten down by the end of the show. And I can't say that my curiosity sort of overruled my feeling of just not necessarily wanting to be in that world anymore by the end of the episode. I couldn't say I was eager for episode two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Julia, so it's unremittingly bleak in tone and content. Also, you know, within 2 minutes of the show starting, you hear someone quoting by name Wittgenstein over the radio. Someone poses the question that Einstein famously posed, whether God plays dice with the universe. Einstein thought no. It made me ask the somewhat smaller question, is television the proper medium for these, you know, rather portenty questions? What did you think? Did you think this was a successful blend of high, low, and medium?
You're trying to provoke my anti-snobbery by getting me to defend the notion that TV would be a perfectly fine medium in which to consider and conjure metaphysical questions, which I do believe. However, I do not think this show is up to it on the execution. I don't think, I mean, I agree with John, it's bleak and I don't want to spend any time in the universe and I don't think I want to watch it. I think the two things that might make me want to watch it more might be if I felt that this great mystery was going to be intriguingly or satisfyingly resolved. And there I have a real trust problem because one of the creators is Damon Lindelof, who's the guy who drove the bus of Lost straight into a wall of just not, you know, creating all these intriguing mysteries that he never explained, that were totally unsatisfyingly resolved, that made the whole show seem to fall apart like a house of cards. Like, why would I get on the Lindelof Express again? I've been burned and I don't need that in my life. The other thing that might make me want to watch it is its sophistication and the elegance with which it contemplates these big life questions, because you don't see them contemplated very often. It is sort of surprising to see a television show that is basically about grief, seemingly, grief and anxiety. I mean, that's not like the log line for that is slightly surprising, right? And I just don't think it seems that smart or sophisticated in how it's telling the story. It relies very heavily on an incredibly overbearing soundtrack. Like, there's sort of scenes where people are supposed to seem tense and they're just like wandering clench-faced around a suburban house, and then the sound falls out and there's just like booming music. Like, I haven't heard music that loud on any show. Just, it felt very ham-fisted. I don't trust the guy who's driving it. I don't think the scenery is that interesting, and it makes me really sad, and I don't want to watch it.
Yeah.
One thing that kept striking me was that it used to be enough for premium cable TV that you had more sex and violence and profanity than you were allowed to have on network. That was the draw. We're way past that point, and now people feel like they need to ask kind of grad school-y, metaphysically loaded big questions, at least on some of these shows, on more of these shows than they used to. And it is getting a little portentous, and a little, just a little gas-filled, it seems to me. And other than that, I know it's sort of bizarre to say it. I kind of liked it. I thought it was creepy. And I sort of became interested in the really large question. The one thing I will say, though, is that when you go, like, we love scrambling low and high. We love scrambling the brows. We love living in this kind of no-brow universe. However, if this were, like, unabashedly highbrow, you would never find out what happened to those people. It would be like a Camus, you know, a contemporary version of the plague or something. And what is it like to be trapped in this world? And what does humanity do to one another when they can't find out the answer to what happened to these people, and on and on and on? That would be so unsatisfying in this medium, and should be. It should remain unsatisfying. You want, like, they've set it up, right? The reason the bus of Lost went over the cliff of Julia Turner's High Expectations and Goodwill was that the setup was so beautiful, and really a beautiful setup turns out to be useless if you don't fulfill it in some equally elegant way. And so I'm worried too that, you know, no matter how much I enjoy the journey, if they don't really nail it with where these people went and why they went there, you're gonna have some angry people. You're gonna have some mobs.
I just like to note that I'm pretty sure one character is reading Camus at some point in this in the pilot.
Yeah.
Am I not wrong?
Yeah. I think
so
you're
they,
right.
They
actually,
seem to
stranger,
be on the same on the same page as you, Steve. But I actually think that my prediction is that this show will ultimately like have a pretty neat and tidy resolution. I just think like Lindelof was really scarred by the reaction to the Lost finale, and I think they're going to overcorrect and ultimately tell us exactly what happened to the 2% of the population that disappeared overnight, for whatever that's worth. I mean, in the same way, you know, True Detective also kind of wrapped its story up in a relatively neat little bow. And I feel like we're at a moment where a lot of creators of shows like this are maybe more likely to give us what we think we maybe want. Although I'm not sure I want that from this show. I think this show could be kind of cool if it didn't tell us. But to Julia's point, if it were entertaining along the way, which I'm not sure the show is.
Okay. Well, the show is called The Leftovers. It's on HBO. It's based on a novel by Tom Parada. It has some genetic material in common with the TV show Lost. Check it out. Let us know what you think of it. Are you hooked? I mean, it doesn't sound like any of us are. I'd watch it again. Sounds like you two are pretty much off the train. Anyway, come to Facebook.com/CultureFest and let us know. Moving on. Are people starting to notice that they hate the internet? For half a generation or so, you like that, huh? For half a generation or so, the net has been every utopian's waking dream. But over time, it's become as routinized and corporatized, as noisy and chaotic, or worse, as falsely intimate as most public spaces. This is the animating spirit behind The Onion's new spin-off parody website, Clickhole. Its most obvious targets are Upworthy and BuzzFeed, though one of the creators says, interestingly, no, it's even worse than that. What he's parodying are his friends' daily postings on their Facebook feeds. We've turned the internet, Julia Turner, from the expansion of the American frontier off into infinity, a preserver of all human liberty, into cute goat videos and confirmation biases of the worst kind. In a word, we've turned it into clickbait. Aren't you guilty as charged as a Slate.com factotum? You're not a factotum. A Slate.com sachem? What are you?
I don't know. What are you at Slate?
A poobah?
Poobah. You're a poobah.
I'll be a poobah. Sounds so sweet. Yeah. So it's funny. I like the way you framed this segment, because I do think with any new medium, with any genre, I mean, we talked about this a little bit with romantic comedies. There's a moment where the creators of the original thing get ahead, and then there are times when the satirists get ahead. And I sort of feel like for the last few years, with the rise of BuzzFeed, and then more recently with the launch of all these different venture-funded sites like Vox.com and 538 over at ESPN, and, you know, all of these various new entrants into the internet space, there has been a rapid expansion of the way in which people tell stories on the internet. And I feel like with Clickhole, the satirists have like caught up. Like they've caught up to where the internet has gotten to in the last year or two, and they now have the internet's number in a manner that is pretty enjoyable to experience. I think it's pretty good and pretty funny, and I think as a creator and poobah of internet content, I think it's good for us. It keeps us honest. It forces us to recognize some of the lazy tropes that even a respectable site like Slate could sometimes fall prey to. And I'm all for it. I think it was really smart. I mean, the real problem with The Onion over the past few years is that the thing they are satirizing is no longer the dominant media stripe. Like they have been satirizing a local newspaper, and that was really, really funny in the era when the local newspaper was not a sad, dying institution. But it became increasingly irrelevant feeling in the last few years. And I think this is a smart pitch back towards relevancy, and I find it pretty pertinent.
Right. Okay. So, John, exactly right. Julia's hit the nail on the head, right? Onion can't go on satirizing this thing, this anachronistic thing, off into infinity forever. Now they're turning to the internet. They don't want to get caught in the same trap as our rom-com satirists. So they're ahead of the game. Let me throw a quote at you that came from the NewYorker.com. Clickhole is funny because so much of the internet is sad. Is that why the satire is so timely? Because we're not yet fully aware of that, but the satire is making us much more aware of it.
Are you asking me whether the internet is sad?
You really do think the romance is gone from life, Steve.
You know, I have to separate myself here because, you know, every day at 3 o'clock, Julia Turner and I sit down and write headlines for the homepage of Slate.com. And so I think we enjoy Clickhole on the level of being perpetrators of writing clickbaity headlines sometimes. We strive not to do that. Have we never written a vaguely clickbaity headline? I don't think I could say that. But then, you know, why is it enjoyable to someone who isn't an editor at a website? I think the reason isn't necessarily that the internet is sad. It's just that there, you know, everyone recognizes that this kind of story is out there now and that this kind of story is irresistible. You know, you can be the most high-minded you can be the most high-minded user of the internet and think that you're logging on to check out the latest from the London Review of Books, but you get to your Twitter feed and you see that BuzzFeed has posted, you know, 10 photographs of basset hounds running through the sand, and the next thing you know, you're on image 9 of that slideshow, or you know, something else, whatever happens to, you know, be your weakness, the internet has found a way to exploit it. And so there's a vague embarrassment that comes with that, or maybe an acute embarrassment that comes with having clicked through to that. And I think Clickhole has done a really great job both of skewering the media organizations who've kind of made that part of their business model, but also I think the sort of rank-and-file internet users recognize that, like, oh, my God, yeah, I've fallen for that before, and this send-up of the kind of thing that I've fallen for is very clever. I'm not sure that it means that the internet is sad. It means that the internet has found a way to deliver great joy that is also not necessarily the most high-minded joy.
I think we should read a few headlines on the site before we get further in this conversation, because if people haven't been reading it, they may not have a strong sense of what we're talking about. 8 on-screen couples with zero chemistry, where they just pick two people in movies who were never intended to have romantic chemistry and talk about how they had none.
That was a good one.
A few more. Quiz, is your dad proud of you? I also really liked Stanley Tucci's racist tirade, Our Take If It Ever Happened, which just has this sort of like hypothetical high umbrage that skewered a very particular stripe of internet writing. It feels like this site is constantly putting its finger on little subcurrents and subthreads of the way different corners of the internet talk, the cliches they fall back upon, in a way that feels fresh and exciting. Like there's now a really good court jester.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. Okay, it's called Clickhole because all content deserves to go viral. That's very funny. And it's a product of The Onion, so check it out. Tell us if you think it's funny. Okay, well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse John Swansburg. What do you have?
At the risk of making a mockery of myself and out Metcalfing Metcalf, I'm going to endorse a favorite romantic comedy of mine. Of course, I speak of Max Ophüls' La Ronde from 1950. It's really less of a romantic comedy than it is a comedy about romance, if you think about it. But La Ronde is this wonderful movie in which there's a series of paramours meet in various places in Vienna in 1900. And we have a pair of lovers meet, and then one separates and goes and meets another lover, and then they separate and one party meets another lover. And then it starts with a prostitute and circles back around to her. And there's this wonderful carousel theme, and it's just a beautiful exploration of romance and its fleetingness.
All right, Julia, what do you got?
I have an endorsement. It's a slightly offbeat one, pegged to our second topic, The Leftovers. If you are curious about the evangelical right and its beliefs about the rapture, you should pick up and read Left Behind, which is the much maligned, much scorned pulp thriller about the rapture. Like, it literally has planes crashing as the pilots go whoop into the sky. And it's if you are not a believer, preposterous, but also kind of a whirlwind tour through what a certain subset of American culture believes is imminent, or at least going to happen at some point. You know, I mean, I read it with anthropological interest. There's also some anti-Semitism in it. It's not like a book I endorse as a good book. But as a way of acquainting yourself with a mode of thinking about the end of the world, if you're the sort of person who hears about the rapture, the end times, or jokes about the apocalypse, but aren't acquainted with what people actually believe about it, it's kind of a good way to acquaint yourself with it. So the book is Left Behind by Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. And if you have mixed feelings about supporting their commercial endeavors, see if you can just find it for free on the back shelf of some rental house this summer. But if you do find it, pick it up and start it. It's a pretty entertaining read.
Oh, my. All right. Well, I'm going to endorse with one eye on the 4th of July, the Declaration of Independence, a study in the history of political ideas. It's by Carl Becker. I believe it was written in the 1920s. I think the first edition of it came out in 22. But it goes into all of the intellectual and historical antecedents to the Declaration, which was, of course, the founding document of the United States written by Thomas Jefferson. And he goes into where the style of it came from, what it meant personally to Jefferson. But it's a beautiful and a small book, and it's careful, precise, elegant, much like the Declaration itself. So anyway, Carl Becker's classic study, The Declaration of Independence, it's called Declaration of Independence, A Study in the History of Political Ideas, a wonderful book, highly recommended.
That sounds great.
John, thank you so much for filling in.
My pleasure. How did I do? You know, you set the bar so high.
You were adequate. I think if she
swish.
Were...
swish.
Swish. I'll say no more.
Adequate from Steve Metcalf. I'll take that.
There you go. Julia Turner, you were, as always, also adequate. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks. You know how to make a girl feel special.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or in the WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate GabFest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Ann Hepperman and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Max Tanney and Anna Schechtman. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.